And for the last 10 weeks, an oral history course has been run out of Charleville Library in Dublin's North Inner City, supported by the North East Inner City Initiative and Dublin City Council. It was open to residents from that area of Dublin. The project focuses on the collection of oral testimony, memories and life experiences of people born into the area or who've spent much of their lives in that part of our capital city. And I'm joined in studio now by three guests, Aideen Leonard, Mary Kennedy and Sonia Shannon, all of whom have been recording interviews with local people and collecting their experiences and memories. You're all very welcome indeed to the History Show.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Aideen, tell us first of all about the project and how you got involved.
Well, this is a funny story about this. I thought that I had seen the leaflet in Charleville Mall Library and then told Mary Kennedy about it. But Mary kindly reminded me the other day that it was the opposite way around.
Right.
That actually Mary saw the leaflet in Charleville Mall and told me about it. So that's how I found out. I do use my library a lot. I'd be there on nearly a weekly basis and they always have their leaflets out. So I saw this and I thought this would be just a fascinating, really enjoyable course, you know, because the North Inner City is such a vibrant area. I've lived in it now for 20 years. I absolutely love it. I love the community I'm in. And I thought, what better way to celebrate living in the North Inner City than to, you know, record some of the stories of our older generation there? So I jumped at the chance to do it.
Is that how you got involved, Sam? We know how Mary got involved. Obviously, it was the same leaflet. Is that how you got involved?
I actually seen it on Facebook.
Yeah.
A local historian, Terry Fagan, shared it on his Facebook. And I just looked at it and thought, yeah, I'd actually like to do that. I'm from the North Inner City. So.
And what... Obviously, you know, it was a lengthy enough course, detailed enough course. Presumably you learned a lot more, Mary, than how to turn on a tape recorder and how to turn it off.
Yeah, so the beginning of the course was based around history. So people who had already done oral history projects. We had a couple of historians in who were really informative. And then we had a couple of weeks where we talked about the morals of the recording, the ethics and the legal side of it.
Okay, so explain that to me, the ethics of recording somebody's
so
memory.
It's like, who owns the recording? The recording is not mine. It's the person who you've interviewed. It's their recording. You need to get consent that they totally understand where the recording can be used. And you explain all this to them. They still have the final consent after that, whether it goes into the archives
or
not.
So if they realise that they've said something that they don't want other people to know about, they can say, no, right, that's
it. You could edit it out, or maybe they might decide they just don't want it to go anywhere. So the final consent is theirs. And this was where the morals came in. Even though legally they've signed a consent form, morally it is their right to refuse.
Aideen, a big theme in these interviews seems to be social life, cultural change. Mm-hmm. Tell me about one person that you spoke to, somebody called Joan Phelan. We'll be hearing from her shortly.
Yes, I've known Joan since I moved into the area. She ran a really traditional old style little local shop on St. James's Avenue in Ballybock with her husband. And the shop was just like stepping back in time. When you walked in the door of that shop, you could be in any little village anywhere in Ireland. Joan was a countrywoman herself, but she had come to Dublin at age 10. You'd never think it by her accent, but she ran that shop. But it was more than a shop. It was like a little cultural exchange area. It was where people came to chat after mass. People came to drop in leaflets and, you know, if there was something going on in the parish, you'd go to Joan's shop, she'd have the poster up. It was a real place where people not just went into shop, but stopped to chat, you know, hear about their neighbours, hear about maybe somebody who died. The first place you'd hear it would be in Joan's shop. So it was more than a shop. It was a real sort of fulcrum for the community.
The great thing, of course, about a project like this is it's not a law court. So therefore, hearsay is very important. And I would imagine someone like Joan would have heard an awful lot in addition to having experienced a lot herself.
Absolutely. You know, she would. Yeah, she was sort of like a sounding board, I suppose, for other people in the community. People would come to her even with problems and advice. You know, I remember her telling me lots of, you know, people would come in even looking for, if they were in trouble and they'd run out of money for their groceries, Joan would have an awful lot of people on tab and they'd pay her whenever they had it.
Hmm. Okay, we'll hear an extract from your interview with Joan Phelan. Here, a couple of them actually. Here you are asking her about one of her favourite pastimes as a young woman.
I used to go dancing. We loved dancing, actually. I danced 7 nights a week if I had money, but and there was no bars in or anything in the dance halls. You could have maybe a cup of tea or a glass of orange or something.
So Joan, describe to me what it was like getting ready to go out to a dance. What was the routine?
Oh, the routine was I had to have my wash my hair, put in my rollers. Now, you didn't wear much makeup in those days because you didn't have the money for it. Probably had a bit of lipstick and maybe a bit of powder or something. And high heels, as high as I could get them. Because I was only 5'2". So, and I was about 18, like, before I was allowed to go out dancing.
And Joan couldn't dance 7 days a week, not just because she didn't have the money, but also because she spent most of her time working.
When I was working in Bolton Street, in that shop, and when I was about 16, I suppose, I got a job in the Palm Grove Cafe in the evening after work, and I worked there until it closed at night.
So you worked two jobs that time?
I worked two jobs because I was the oldest of a family of 10, and I used to have to send home money to them for to dress them for confirmation or first communion or whatever. And also, my mother had to get all her teeth out, so I contributed, bought her her first set of dentures.
I see what you mean about the accent, by the way. Does not sound like someone who only spent the first 10 years of her life living down the country.
No, it's remarkable, yeah.
Extraordinary, yeah. The way she hung on to the accent. That was the voice of Joan Phelan there. Sonia, the interviews also include observations on local institutions. And one of your interviewees, Chrissy Byrne, spoke about the Magdalen Laundry on Sean McDermott Street. Like many of the people interviewed, she was someone you knew from living in the area. So tell us a little bit about Chrissy.
Well, Chrissy, she's lived in the inner city all her life. She lived in Dublin tenements, in the old tenements. And in her interview, she just talks about life in the tenements and growing up and the area and everything that was in it. And just life was so simple. And then she talks about the Magdalen Convent. The flat complex that she lived in, it overlooked the yard of the convent. So Chrissy remembers the girls calling up and asking her for cigarettes, and she used to throw cigarettes.
How far back could she take you in terms of living in the tenements? I mean, roughly speaking, roughly what? I don't know exactly what age she is, but what decade is she in?
Well, Chrissy is in her 80s,
right?
So she was born in the inner city. So right from when she was very young, there was 14 of them in our family. They lived in a 2-bedroom, so she could remember just having an open fire, nothing else, no electricity, you know.
So it's almost Sean O'Casey, really, isn't it? Not, I mean, it's a little bit after Sean O'Casey, but things wouldn't have changed all that much.
Yeah.
Okay, let's hear from Chrissy Byrne talking to Sonia about her memories of the site where the Magdalen Laundry once operated on Sean McDermott Street.
We didn't think anything was going on, only that we were doing the laundries. But nobody ever put anything to it till all this come out. We used to throw the cigarettes and all over to the young ones that was there. There was a big square at the back of the convent when you come out on the break, and we used to throw them over. We'd be talking from the windows, from the flats. But nobody knew what was going on. Nobody.
Did you ever meet any of the girls from there?
I knew a couple of them now that they were put in for school. There was an awful lot put in for school. And then the poor girls that was brought up from the country where I had babies, their parents put them in, but they were signed in. Anyone that was signed in couldn't get out.
Did they interact with the people in the community?
No. So nobody saw them. You see, they were all in the back doing the laundries for the hotels and hospitals and all the whole day. You never saw them. You only saw the nuns when you were going in to collect your clothes.
And that was Chrissy Byrne recording her memories of the Magdalen Laundry in Dublin's northeast inner city. Sonny also spoke to Paddy Malone, and he shared his memories of growing up as a pupil at the Artane Industrial School, a fairly grim establishment.
Yeah, Paddy Malone, I didn't actually know Paddy was in the Christian Brothers before I interviewed him. That's something that just came out when I started talking to him. But Paddy was born in a Magdalen convent. And he was moved from there to an orphanage in Kilkenny, and then moved from Kilkenny then to
Artane. So he had a great start in life.
Yeah, so he was there until he was 16. And then once you're 16, then they just, that's it, bye-bye.
Okay, well, we'll talk about the bye-bye afterwards, but let's hear an extract from your interview with Paddy Malone, where he talks about life at the school, at Artane Industrial School.
You were a number, more or less, you were always referred to by a second name. You were never referred to by a first name, which has more or less been a number. You got up in the morning and either breakfast or mass first, I can't remember which, you know, but there was a religious service every morning. Breakfast then, which with 800 people, so you can imagine what it was like. You know, everything was just mass produced and, you know, nothing of nutritious benefit as such. And if there was, it was mass produced and it was burnt or overcooked or, you know, because they were cooking for so many. And it was just put in front of you and it was a battle to eat. You know, whoever was senior on the table, there was about 20 people on each table. So whoever was tops on the table got preference and, you know, and you didn't complain, you know. But the regime, it was Christian Brothers and the regime was absolutely brutal. And the interesting thing was that you accepted it because you knew no better. And that was always the thing about institutional care, particularly from a young age. If you were in care from a young age, you didn't experience the usual family emotional feelings that other children did. You never realised what you missed out until after you were 16 years of age.
Very, very tough first 16 years of Paddy Malone's life. Very hard to listen to, I have to say. Harrowing and emotional description there of life growing up in the Artane Industrial School. And then he leaves at 16. And what happens?
He left at 16 and he went to a hostel in Ecclestree for young men. And when he was in the hostel, he realised that there was nothing for any of the kids to do. He went out to work and then there was nothing to do later on in the night. So he set up a kind of a club, a youth club, within the hostel. And he put billboards and snooker or whatever it was at the time for the kids. And then from then, Paddy volunteered and is still volunteering. He's retired now in youth work and minding kids and making sure to get everything that he didn't get in our Artane Industrial School. He's an incredible man.
Yeah, Mary, you spoke to a man called Michael Denver, and he wasn't a pupil at Artane, but he did recall visiting there. Just tell us a little bit about Michael first before we hear this clip.
Okay, so Mick Denver, he's a neighbour. I know him a fairly long time. He's a character. So he had no problem doing the interview. He was very happy to do it. He's great. His memories are great. Like during the different parts of the interview, he can name every shop that used to be in the area, families who lived where everywhere, you know. He's a brilliant memory. But his uncle, he used to work after school with his uncle who had a confectionery business. And he used to help him deliver things. And then when he started serving his apprenticeship as a carpenter, he used to work with his uncle in the evenings just to earn a few bob. So I think one of the clips is
because it relates back to what Sonia was saying about Artane and to Paddy Malone. Who knows? It may even involve Paddy Malone, but we'll see. We'll hear from Mick Denver speaking to Mary, and he describes visiting the Artane school with his uncle.
I went into Artane as a young fella because my uncle used to deliver confectionery sweets to the shop, the tuck shop, as it was called. And when I was walking with him, I'd go in there into the, and I'd see all the young fellas in their short trousers, tweedy type suits on them and the hobnail boots. And the young fellas would come around with the handcart and we'd load up all the toffee bars and all the stuff, big orders like. And they'd run around to the tuck shop. We'd load the cart and they were going around to empty it to come back again. And I noticed one young fellow standing in the doorway, and when the cart was going by, the fella slowed up and that man pulled a box of sweets off it. And of course, I said, what's this? They're robbing our sweets. And I said to my uncle, I said, does that fella have to take a box of sweets? He said, I know, they always do that. We don't mind that. That was a little treat to young fellows. If they were caught doing that, they were in serious trouble.
And that was Mick Denver, and as I say, he could have been talking, that could have been Paddy Malone who was nicking the sweets, and a very small amount of pleasure for him. Mary, you interviewed also somebody called Eileen MacDonald, and she remembered the Great North Strand floods of 1954, which I have to say is something I've never ever heard of. So we'll hear a short extract first.
Back then in 1954, with the floods, you had no insurance. How did you manage?
We had house insurance for fire and theft.
But not for flooding?
Oh, no, no.
And how did you replace everything?
How did we? We didn't. My father used to go up and buy second-hand things anywhere he could get furniture and bring it, because we didn't have a car, and he'd get a man up the road there to bring down this and that and the other.
And you actually remember those floods yourself from your childhood?
I do, yeah. I remember the water coming up. I was quite young. The water coming up. We lived at the top of a hill, and I was in Clontarf at the time. But I do remember the water coming to the bottom of the road. But I've seen photographs of rowing boats in North Strand. People have been taken out of buildings on other people's shoulders. There's quite a big...
It was the seawater.
It was. I think the railway bridge collapsed into the Talca. And the Talca overflowed, but it must have been very high tides because the whole of the seafront was flooded as well. So I think the water was coming in from everywhere. It was very serious, but they've had constant floods since then. And the houses where Eileen lives, they have basements and they've suffered constantly from flooding and still can't get flood insurance.
Before we go, we're going to hear one more story from Mick Denver. This is quite an amusing story, actually. He recalls his own experience of television arriving in Ireland.
I remember a fellow around the Spring Garden Passage. I used to knock around with him. Damon Higgins was his name. And he was the only child in the house. But they got a television. And you could see nothing on it. Absolutely nothing, because there was no television station here, no RTE or anything like that. Signals had come from Northern Ireland, and they'd be trying to pick them up here, and all you see was snow, and occasionally you might get a glimpse of a person, you know, very hard to see. But even at that, we used to sit down and watch it, and all the other kids in the street, they wouldn't let into the house. But they'd be all outside the window and the curtains would be open and they'd be all looking in at the television. And that's how we got our enjoyment there with that. And then I remember we got our own television. And when television came in and we'd sit around looking at that. That was in Spring Garden Street now. But I remember a girl came one time, knocked at the door, and she had a new gimmick for the television. And it was like a big magnifying glass that you put in front of the television and it made the screen bigger. I don't know how much it was, but everyone bought them. They were useless. Absolutely useless.
Great story there from Michael Denver. And you, Mary, you reckon a lot of people you talk to, you don't remember them yourself, but other people do.
But I did relate the story to several people. And last night I was just actually talking to Eileen's husband, Eileen's daughter. And Eileen's daughter's husband said they had one as well, that everybody had these magnifying things.
Small television screens, but
a little television. They were only small tellies. And then you had this big magnifying glass thing in front of it.
And you probably had to be the next street to be able to see them properly. Right. Nice idea, but just doesn't work. Aideen, are you going to keep doing this?
Absolutely. I had no idea I'd enjoy it so much, and I want to keep going now. There's so many other amazing people. I interviewed another man called Paddy Tucker, who lives beside St. Agatha's Church, and Paddy had the most incredible memory and hilariously funny stories. And like Mary, he remembered every shop. He remembered characters like Hector Gray and a man who used to tear telephone books in half, and, you know, characters that came and entertained the children in the North Inner City, and street games, all of that kind
Hector
of stuff.
Hector Gray was the great sales.
That's right. Yes. But yeah, definitely want to keep doing it.
Okay. Right. And the same with you, Sonia, and you, Mary, as well. Yeah, you'll keep at it.
Oh, definitely.
Loved it.
Okay. Well, sure. We'll have you back. Maybe give it a year or so. We'll have you back and see what you've come up with between now and then, and maybe track down a few more of those poor unfortunates who were sold magnifying glasses
or cellophane to make the black and white. They cellophane. Had cellophane in front, coloured cellophane.
To make
you could put it to make a black and white television colour.
I want to hear that one. I don't want to hear that one, how that one worked out. Oral history projects, very important at preserving the living memory of our history. And Aideen Leonard, Mary Kennedy, Sonia Shannon, many thanks for joining us this evening and sharing those extracts from the interviews. And do come back, give it a year or so, do come back and we'll see what you've come up with. All of the interview recordings collected by participants in the course will be deposited with Dublin City Library and Archive, and they'll be preserved and made publicly accessible early next year. Thank the three of you all very, very much.
Thank you. Thanks again. Very much.